Hello, my fine friends, and welcome to episode 8 of Destination Discourse. I'm your host, Stuart Butler, joined today, as ever, with my good friend. What's your name? I've forgotten it. No, I haven't really. It's Adam Stoker.
Yep, Adam Stoker. Thank you for remembering, Stuart. I got a little nervous there for a second, but glad to be here.
See, I broke the fourth wall a little bit because I'm continuing a joke that we had before we started recording that no one would get because we were talking about me messing up Amir's name a couple of weeks ago. But anywho, it's Adam Stoker. And then I'm also joined here with my brand new friend, Zeke Coleman from Tourism Economics. Zeke, how are you today?
Hey, Sue. Really good. Excited to be here.
We're excited. Now, you are one of those folks in the industry that has gone from the light side to the dark side, right? You used to be at the DMO at Visit Savannah, went to Adara, now at Tourism Economics. It's a lot of you folks that switch the wrong way. You're meant to come the other way from the dark side to the light side over to the DMOs. But glad to have you today. We're going to have a fun discussion. We're going to be talking about correlation versus causation. Are people confusing the two? That's going to be the topic today. But guess what, guys? Before we get into that, I know this is the moment you've been waiting for your entire lives, not just for the past week, but it is time for the number one segment in the industry. It's time for Stu's News. You ready?
Let's do it.
And have you given up on the jingle thing, Adam?
I'm just so disappointed that we haven't been able to get enough traction on that because I just want to play it so bad. But I'm going to do a few reposts here and there and see if we can't get a little more momentum behind it.
Well, you know what? And now this show is not just on YouTube. It is now also streaming, or not streaming, but it's out on podcast in audio format. And I have all the power on the edit, so I can put a jingle in if I want. I could make fun of you even more than I already do if I want. I mean, there's a lot of options here, so stay tuned. And if you're watching on YouTube, be sure to check it out on audio format too, because there might be a few little surprises and hidden Easter eggs in that version. Well, let's jump into Stu's News, shall we? You guys ready for this?
Let's do it.
So you haven't seen this article yet, Adam and Ozzy. And so Google just came out with their quarterly report. And there's nothing too surprising in it. You know, $88 billion in revenue, something like $76 billion of that is search, which, you know, people keep talking about how they're growing all these other services and like cloud services and business services. And they're growing significantly, but still the vast majority of their revenue is coming from search, which I think we would all agree is a very brittle and precarious situation for Google to be in. But that's not what I wanted to talk about today. Today, I wanted to talk about, they've hit a benchmark, which is, I think, seismic and will send shockwaves through every industry. And that is that 25% of all the code that Google is creating now is created by AI. Now, that blew my mind when I saw the stat. Keeping in mind, they do still have humans supervising. So it's a human in the loop approach. 25% of the code is written by AI, and then a human comes back and reviews it. But what's your initial reaction to this? I just threw this truth bomb on you guys, but I'll throw it to you first, Adam. What do you think about this milestone that Google's reached?
Well, I think it was bound to happen, first of all, just with the amount of scalability that AI gives different teams. And dev was one of the areas that seemed like it could be the most disrupted because of the way dev language is written. It's very repeatable and it's very logical. And I think you can build a lot of logic into these large language models that allows it to do that. My team has been playing around with a couple of different products. One's called Cursor AI. And Cursor AI has allowed us to get really non-developers to get 80% of the way to where they need to get. And then we need a developer to kind of clean it up and get at the final 20%. There's another product out there that I think is even getting farther. And I can't remember off the top of my head what the name of that product is. But I think what it is going to allow Google and other organizations to do is not to decrease dev staff per se, but and some of them may, but I think what it's going to allow Google to do now is to become 25% more efficient, get 25% more done than they would have otherwise. And I actually think we're going to see the rate at which Google launches new products and new services to the industry, I think we're going to see that increase in acceleration quite a bit. So I'm excited to see what happens. I it doesn't surprise me that it's gotten here. I think in less than 2 years, that number will be over 50%, but it really is an interesting milestone to see them hit already.
Yeah. Zeke, what'd you think?
I feel surprised. I guess I shouldn't be, but I do feel surprised because when I try to get AI or ChatGPT specifically to create a macro for me for Excel, it does well, but not good enough. And so I don't, yeah, don't feel that good. I did at PCMA earlier this year, the chief, former chief business officer, I think that's right, for Google said that he actually thinks AI by the end of this year. He said right now its IQ is like 150 if it had an IQ. It's like an Elon Musk, Albert Einstein kind of level. And that was in January. He said by the end of the year, it should be 300. And in 2 years, I think we will reach, I can't remember the term, if it's
The
singularity or
singularity,
what. Yeah, there you
yeah,
go. There
singularity,
you go.
AGI, yeah,
Yeah, he said you'd
artificial
reach
general
that.
intelligence, yeah.
Yep. And he said, even today, he was on Zoom, by the way. He said, you don't even know if I'm real. It's good enough today that you don't know if this is me or my avatar that I've trained to be my presenter on Zoom. And you can do that in 73 different languages. Anyway, he said that he thinks they're a lot further along than what people thought at the time. And so this kind of validates that.
Yeah, it's interesting. I've been sort of reflecting on the journey we've been in, and it really has, it's been about 2 years since it really hit mainstream, right? Obviously, artificial intelligence has been around a lot longer, but with generative AI to the masses, it's been about 2 years. And there's been some iterative improvements, and on a day-to-day basis, you don't really notice it. But when you think back about how far we have come and how much better GPT is, GPT-4o is than it was when it first came out. I mean, it's night and day, and we're on the cusp of five, which is, from what everything people are speculating, is going to be a whole nother quantum leap. And the analogy I've heard people use is right now, it's intelligent in certain ways, but it's also dumb in certain ways, right? It sort of acts a bit like an intern. You have to be really specific and be prescriptive. But we're very close to it becoming past PhD level, right? And so, to your point, that IQ is just going to continue to increase. But I think what Google's doing is the right approach, human in the loop, right? Don't let the computer, the machine, take control. 25%, you could look at it another way. Well, 75% is still being written by a human, right? Which is good, and that gap's going to close. To Adam's point, I do think there's something interesting going on. If you look at the workforce, places like Google and Twitter and Meta and all these others were traditionally adding significantly large numbers of new employees every year. Like they were growing 10, 20% in terms of especially developers every year. And that has stalled out, right? So whereas I think you're right that people aren't going to lose their jobs that have their jobs. I think what is beginning to happen is we're seeing that the demand for new jobs isn't there like it was previously. So that's long,
Well,
obviously long term creates a bit of a threat.
I think I'll the only place I'll push back there is I agree with you with a lot of, but I do think that people will lose their jobs if they refuse to evolve, if they refuse
Yeah.
to move along with the rate of technology. And I think those that like the way they've always done it and want to continue to do it the way they've always done it, even if they're a developer, they will lose their job. And I think this is a telltale sign of that because if 25% of the code is now being written by AI, the humans have to evolve with it.
Yeah. And I have a good friend, Tim Peter, who's one of the most tweetable people I've ever met. He has a really good podcast called Speaks Out Loud with Tim Peter. And he just has these little lines that just sum it up. And his related to that is AI won't replace your job, but smart people that use AI will, And so that's the approach that the DMO industry needs to understand that if we're not If we haven't, in the 2 years that it's been out, if we haven't incorporated generative AI into our daily workflow, then we're already behind our competition. Like, there's not a team member on the Visit Myrtle Beach staff that doesn't use AI on a daily basis. I use it all the time. I use it for this show. Like, I use it to take the transcript of the show. I use it to take the transcript and turn it into the show notes. I use it to take the show notes and turn that into a LinkedIn post, right? that those are things that were taking me hours before and now taking me 10 minutes, you know? So
The logo for
it's
the
an
show.
the logo for the show was can I go on a little side note here? Because this is a
Yeah,
funny
let's do
story.
it.
So I used ChatGPT or DALL-E for the image generation for the logo for the show, and it's notoriously bad at letters. What it does, what AI does, is it tokenizes letters into essentially a number, right? And then it tries to generate the image based on that. And there's different AI, generative AIs that do better with images, but DALL-E has some issues when it comes to words. And I kept trying to get it to say destination discourse. And it would come up with this amazing logo, but it would be destination discourse without the R. It kept missing the R for some reason. And I was spelling it right, and I tried it a million times. Occasionally, it would put something that looked a bit like an R in there, and I was getting so frustrated. And then finally, I'm like, I'm just going to tell it to generate a logo. And I spelled it with two R's. I put destination discourse with two R's, and it came out with a logo that you guys see. Like it just ignored the first one and added the second one for some reason. So sometimes the human has to trick the AI into doing what it wants, but it worked, right? I don't have any design skills, and so I couldn't have done that without AI. But everyone needs to embrace it if they haven't already. So let's move on. Adam, I want you today to set up this topic. This was your guest. This is your idea. So tell us why should people care about this topic of correlation versus causation?
Yeah, and really, I've been excited about this episode. Zeke and I talked about him coming on, I think at this point, maybe even a month and a half ago or so. And I've really wanted to touch on this. 10 years ago, as we were trying to navigate destination marketing, there was so few data resources available. I mean, at the time, it was like the hotel collects the revenue. The destination does the advertising, and the data connection is non-existent between the two, which made it almost impossible to measure the effectiveness of what we were doing in the destination marketing field. And so I was really excited when a lot of these new data companies started popping up, and they're not so new anymore, but when they came out, they were new. And I loved what I was seeing. There was Zartico, Datafy, there's Adara, obviously has products. Arrivalist has products. Tourism Economics, which Zeke will talk probably a little bit about today, has products for these data connections. And finally, we were able to actually see some of the closing of the loop between the destination doing the marketing and the visitor actually visiting. And over time, as I've watched those data companies develop their products and develop the way they communicate about those products to the industry, there was a point, and I actually can't remember the time when it was, but I started to go, wait a second, we may be going too far with what we're saying we're capable of now. And that led me to the question of, are we, just because we're so excited about the data connections that are now there, are we jumping over correlation between what tactics happened from a marketing perspective and that people visited? Or have we gone all the way to say that it's causation, meaning that the action that has the data connection is also the cause of the visit instead of being one of the data points that influenced the visit? And I think if we jump too far into the causation side of things and start claiming that every tactic that happens to have the data connection with the visitor was the causing factor, we're going to end up with a whole bunch of destinations that are doing direct response media without going to the work to build a brand that in most cases led to the ultimate data connectable action that took place. And I'm a little nervous about overcorrecting, skipping correlation, and attributing everything to causation. And that's why I wanted Zeke to come on. Zeke's been on the DMO side, did a ton of great work at Savannah, especially on the digital marketing side, and has now been at two different data companies. And actually, Zeke, one of the things that you said that made me really excited to have you on this is even that you're using ChatGPT to help you develop macros that you can use in Excel and be even more efficient in Excel. Only somebody that is deep in the data is using ChatGPT to build macros in Excel. So it just shows how much work you're doing on the data side. I'd love to have you maybe give your overview of, first of all, is my hypothesis incorrect? Are we overcorrecting into causation? And where do you think we're at as an industry from a data perspective?
Yeah, great preface. And I mean, I would say we're all over the place, and I think it's a couple different reasons. There was a lot of turnover during the pandemic, and you had a lot of new people come in. So you've got people that have been in the industry for, 20, 30 years, and you've got people that come from really smart industries like CPG, and they're like, "What are we doing?" And then you've got just everybody in the middle. We've seen some good things. We've seen some bad things. We've gotten bitten by the snake oil salesman who sold us a bill of goods. I had my share of that at Visit Savannah, and everything in between. I think we've all bought enough of the tools to know that they can't take credit for everything. No one can, because you can't see everything. You're not connected to everything. There are too many gaps. And I think the industry is probably ready for a more nuanced conversation. The challenge was, if I had been telling my board for 5, 10 years that we were responsible for, 80% of what was coming in that we touched, it's really hard to want to walk that back and say, "No, actually, I was wrong." And I know at Savannah, we were really thoughtful about any time we introduced a new metric or KPI. We tried to introduce it parallel to what we were using, to kind of, gently give that to our stakeholders. But I think that's the tension, is I don't want to look like I made stuff up or I was lying. And so then I don't want to show smaller numbers, because I have some stakeholders that are just all about the number. They think I'm their revenue manager. And so, that makes it tough.
Yeah. And it's tough. I think it is tough, because I think there's two things going on, two questions, existential questions that DMOs ask ourselves. One is, what is our role, right? Which is, is my role to generate demand for the destination, and then let the free market sort of capitalize on that, let the hotels and the attractions sort of fight for the scraps on the demand that I generated. So should I focus my efforts top of funnel and let the businesses in town operate bottom of funnel, right? And we've probably swung that pendulum a little too far on the on that in that direction of going too top of funnel, and we started coming back a little bit towards the bottom of funnel. So I think that's one question, is what is our role as a DMO? And then the other one, which I think we're getting to, is how do I define success in the operations of this organization? So is my success measured in a traditional sense by ROAS or ROI, right? Or is my success measured on my ability to appease my and keep my stakeholders happy so that we remain funded, right? And so I think that's the tension that we get into with DMOs. A lot of times we're so focused on looking good to our stakeholders, whether that be our board, whether that be our elected officials, because we want to justify our existence, that we forget to really look at, well, the data and the results should be determining how and where I spend my money, not that I exist, right? And then we get caught in this game of the only thing I have to do is spend my budget every year and make sure these guys are happy. And it almost doesn't matter, as long as a tax is being collected and all this other stuff, it almost doesn't matter if I'm spending it in the right places. And I think that's the risk, right? If we jump all the way to, we're saying it's causation, everything that happens is because of us, and we lose that sight of what's happening in the middle, then I don't think we can make intelligent decisions as marketers about where to invest our dollars and how to do it most effectively.
Well, and this
Can
is
I
where I
give you?
think. Oh, go ahead, Zeke. Why don't you
I
respond
was
to
going to
that?
give you guys something that's interesting. So I started at a company. I'll just say I started at, well, I won't say any names. I don't want to get sued. Let's just say an internal, like, ad tech, ad ops guy said, he said, "Zeke, do you want the red pill or the blue pill?" And I said, "Give me the red pill." And he said, "DMOs force us to give them these inflated numbers. They know it's not as big as what they force us to give them. We know it's not as big as what they force us to give them." Most of the media companies do retargeting to to then take care or take it credit for things that were already going to happen, and we're forced to do it. And I add to that that I know that okay, we have investors, we have thresholds we got to hit, we got numbers, and so who in the organization, when they're asking me for these numbers, and my investors are asking me for these numbers, and we got to hit this number of new logos, who's going to give the industry the red pill? I don't think there's anyone generally that's in a position to do that because all of their, livelihoods depend on it, right? I have a job in a company. They have a job in a company. Like, who wants to do that? So that also makes it tricky.
It is, but it's a house of cards, right? I think we're all buying into this illusion that's being conjured up, and at some point that becomes really fragile and could collapse pretty quickly. It could take just a couple of really high profile DMOs to call BS, or get defunded, and then the whole thing collapses, because we tend to be sheep as an industry, right? If we see something happen, it hits us like a tidal wave. But I don't know, Adam, what do you think about that? Do you think this that we're all bought into this this red pill kind of concept?
I really do. I think there's going to be some probably disagreement in the industry on where the fault lies for that, because I think that, Zeke, you bring up a really interesting point that, well, the board wants us to demonstrate that we're crushing it. We want to be able to justify our existence by demonstrating that we're crushing it. And that's why when some of these data connections came out, there was so much excitement to run and tell the board about this. But now I think a lot of DMOs may be getting out over their skis. And when the natural, or I should say global tourism economy has a pullback of some sort, and the revenge travel phenomenon after COVID is now winding down, what do we do when 2024 doesn't look like 2023? What do we do when 2025 doesn't look like 2024? And yet all our tactics look exactly the same. And we told them that those data connections were driving, or that our actions proven by these data connections were driving the actual travel. Then why, when the economy pulls back, is this all changing? And I think that's where I've heard more this year about unrest between boards and DMOs than I've ever heard. And we're actually going to have Bill Geist come on and talk a little bit about that in a later episode. But I think one of the reasons there's so much unrest between boards and DMOs right now, and I think that's going to get worse, is because DMOs have been telling a performance story when in fact it was more the economy, or it was more natural travel habits that were changing, and we were rushing to take credit for it. And now we're holding our hat when the economy changes. And that's the part that makes me really nervous, is what will that, I mean, Zeke, you talked about the turnover that happened in the industry during COVID. Well, if there's such a large amount of unrest between boards and the DMOs, I think we're going to see another massive turnover event and a major philosophy change that needs to take place in the relationship between marketing and the data that we have to report on it.
Yeah, yeah. Totally.
And it's not...
Go for it.
Go ahead, Zeke. No, please. You're our guest.
I was just going to say, I mean, I think I will say this. If take Colorado, they were defunded, right? They stopped advertising. One of the things that does happen is if you aren't advertising and others are advertising, you will probably lose your share of the market, depending on who your closest competitors are, if they're getting in front of your potential visitors. So I don't think it's, I to be fair to the industry, I don't think it's all correlative visitation that was happening. I think that we do move the needle. I ran a campaign in August in Savannah when August is historically bad. Occupancy, at that time was 50 to 60%. I took over Expedia for a week, and it was before August. Expedia showed significant lift, and our August was at like 85% for the first time ever. And I did take credit. I said, guys, there is nothing else that changed in our entire market, mm-hmm. except we were the only thing on Expedia for a week. I think that kind of stuff happens and is real. So I guess I'm wanting to defend some of the industry. Like, it does have an impact for sure.
No, for sure. I mean, I think if we didn't believe that marketing has an impact, then none of us would be able to wake up and look at ourselves in the mirror every morning, right? It has a non-zero impact. And I think the challenge is there's a truth somewhere between we have no impact and we have all the impact, right? That there's a spectrum and we live somewhere on that spectrum. I think we've tended to take the far extreme version of that we have all the impact. But to Adam's point, I think there's so many macro trends that impact at destinations, probably more than marketing does, but marketing is sort of the extra 5-10%, right? But if unemployment is bad, or if inflation is high, or if there's a global pandemic, like we can't control those factors. We can only control what we do. And I think we tend to claim credit for things that we shouldn't. And I think long term, that's going to bite us in the butt. And I'll talk about it from a hotel perspective. That was where I was on the hotel side, on the agency side, before I came over to the light side at the DMO. But we used to work with multiple vendors. And it's easier for hotels because you're handling the transaction. Right? You can see a direct correlation or direct causation from an ad to a booking. But what we started seeing is if we added up the attribution that everyone was claiming, so, okay, pay-per-click's claiming 100% attribution because this click came from here. But then email is claiming 100% attribution. And then, oh, that person that clicked on the email and clicked on the paid ad also came back organically later and looked for reviews and came back to the website. Oh, and then they saw a digital ad because we remarketed to them because they came to the website through Sojourn or someone else. And now they're claiming 100%. And then by the end of it, you look at this, even if you have a complex attribution model, you're like, it's like, oh, this ad or this booking has like 400% attribution attributed to it. And it's like, that clearly doesn't make sense, right? Because the truth is they all contributed, but we don't really know to what degree. And I think we've taken that as the industry to the extreme because we don't control the transaction. So we're just basically saying, anyone that shows up in our destination, we had something to do with it. And we're not sure how much we had to do with it. So we're just going to claim it all. And I just don't think that's sustainable. It's not defensible. And at the end of the day, there is going to be a day of reckoning for every DMO. And it's cyclical, right? You just need one difficult person on the board to start poking and asking the wrong questions. And the house of cards collapses. So I think we just got to have more intellectual honesty with ourselves and our stakeholders to say, here's what we know and what we can measure, and this is positive. Here's other things we're observing, but we're really not sure what that means or what we contributed. But then we tie that into one overall narrative that DMOs are having a positive impact on the community. Now, does that mean that we have a 200-to-1 ROI? Probably not. But the truth is we're having a non-zero impact that is positive on our community. And I think we just got to start being honest with each other and with our stakeholders.
Well, Stuart, I think what you're basically saying in discussing how, you know, we can look at correlation and see all these different touch points and claim attribution, and then you end up with that 400% attribution for a single visitation. I think mm-hmm. the solution for that is we do all need to come up with what our attribution model is going to be for our destination. And I think that's probably one of the places where there's room for a major emergence from a thought leadership perspective to happen, for somebody to truly design an attribution model for our industry. And for those that are joining us that may not know what an attribution model is, that's essentially taking the different touch points that we're aware of that happened with a potential visitor, or I guess I should say an actual visitor, because we're attributing that visit. What percentage of credit do you give the different touch points that we can measure so that collectively you can understand what actually influenced that transaction? And, you know, there's a couple of different philosophies. One of the, I think, laziest philosophies is called last click, where you give the majority.
It's the easiest, right? It's lazy, but it's easy, right? Because it's the most trackable, the most visible, the most defensible on the surface.
But it's the one that leads to the biggest conflation of correlation and causation, because you just give a massive amount of credit to the last interaction you had with a customer. And this is where Google pay-per-click will sometimes look like you're highest performing digital channel when something caused them to do that Google search, right? And yet we're going to give the most credit to the click that came from that Google search. And so there's a couple of other ones. There's time decay where, you know, the closer you get to the transaction, those touch points get a higher portion of the credit than the ones that happened, say, 2, 3, 4 months ago that you can track. And there's several others, right? Time decay seems to me to be a little bit more accurate. But I feel like there's room in our industry for somebody to develop an attribution model that not only DMOs accept as being kind of the right way to look at it, but also boards are educated and understand how to evaluate the performance based on that attribution model. And I'm not sure we're in a position to truly release that.
Yeah. Well, it's hard, right? Because we don't control the transaction, and an attribution model has to end in some kind of action, which is, you know, typically DMOs end at either a website visit or a click to a member or an investor, right? They're not typically tracking conversions. Although we do at Visit Model Beach, we use a product called Flip2 to allow us to go through to the conversion. I think I'll push back a little, Adam, because I don't think a singular attribution model is ever going to be effective, because every attribution model you can ever conceive of has bias baked into it naturally, right? And so if you do a time decay, it's obviously biased towards bottom of funnel versus top of funnel. So you can end up attributing more value to things like pay-per-click than you would to, say, a display ad. Things like a linear distribution have the opposite, right? They're going to favor some of the earlier things perhaps more than they should. I'm a big fan of things like J-shaped or U-shaped attribution model, where you sort of over-inflate the attribution at the beginning and the end of all the touch points, right? I think those are good. But the reality is there's no one singular model that's going to tell you the full story or help you make decisions. And at the end of the day, data should be there to help us make decisions, not justify our position, right? And so if I'm looking to say, should I spend more money in this channel or this channel, well, it really depends where that channel hits someone in the journey, right? If they're high in the funnel, low in the funnel. And I just realized the irony of saying funnel a lot when we had an argument a couple of episodes ago.
I don't want to say funnel. That I'm vindicated or anything like that, but it is interesting to hear your usage of that term.
Yeah, I'm dumbing it down for you, Adam, but let's keep going. So the reality is you should use an attribution model based on the decision you're trying to make. So if you're trying to make a decision about something that's top of funnel versus top of funnel, then use one attribution model. If you're trying to look holistically, use a different attribution model. And then talk intelligently about, here's what we observe with this attribution model. Here's the biases in this attribution model. Now, here's what we see this other attribution model, and here are the biases. And then we can have an honest conversation and develop a narrative around that. But it's complicated, and no one is really doing that in the industry. So I agree with you, Adam. I think it's an opportunity. So I'm going to throw it to Tourism Economics. You guys can take this one and run with it.
Yeah, I want to hear Zeke's response.
And we've actually, so we've undertaken to do exactly what you're talking about. I will share that when it was suggested by Adam that we take out, we net out those that were going to come anyway, I said, Adam, do you understand? I told him the red pill story. And I was like, you understand that, like, the industry has never done this. You're going to potentially give a lower number than they've been giving. You're probably going to give a lower number because we know. And it's going to be more variable based on how effective they are at doing the things that Stu was just saying. So he was defiant and said, I don't care. We're not putting out numbers that aren't, you know, defensible, that aren't real. He's said, I've had my share of skepticism anyway about, you know, the effectiveness of some of this stuff. If we're going to be in it, we're going to do it in a way that's reasonable. And it doesn't mean that we're going to do it and we're the only ones that can do it right. It just means that we're going to be much more iterative in our model and start with things like a control group. So one of the things we did was we have a global feed of all the users that we can see traveling, and we're using mobile location data, and so we're seeing all the home locations, common evening locations of those users that then come into a destination. So everyone's visitation rate, if you will, into the destination, comparing that to those that are exposed, and netting out, those that were probably going to come anyway based on what it is without exposure, and also creating, not lookalikes, but kind of like a lookalike group. So these people are from the same census block and exhibit similar travel behaviors. So you're not comparing Zeke, who travels twice a week, 39 weeks of the year, to Sam, who travels, 3 times a year, and saying now, basically skewing it because I travel so much. But I think things like that are smart, and I think being collaborative instead of guarded. The more that we partner with smart companies, we were just on with, talking with Tempest, and those guys were talking about how websites can be, load times can affect how much you can do website attribution. Like, does the pixel even fire? Like, that's super smart, and that's those guys' expertise. If we partner with them and say, how do you think this should work? This is what you do best. Here's what we do best. And coming together, we can actually build some pretty cool things, similar to what Amazon and those in CPG do on their side. So I think there's hope.
That's neat. I'm glad this helped. Go ahead, Adam.
I like that, Zeke. A couple things. One for the audience, when Zeke talks about somebody that's super smart named Adam, he's talking about Adam Sachs, not Adam Stoker. If
To be honest, Adam, I don't think you had to clarify. I don't think anyone was under any illusion that
if somebody's talking about the dummy in the industry with a podcast, that's Adam Stoker. And so for everybody that's
that's
listening,
right. That
that's the
hat guy,
difference.
the guy that wears hats all the time.
But Stuart, I'm gonna actually combine a little bit of what Zeke said with some pushback to your comment, because when you say that everybody needs to kind of develop their own attribution model, I think what you end up with is the problem we're encountering today, because everybody, it's kind of the wild, wild west, and everybody's reporting. I shouldn't say everybody, a large number of DMOs, especially the less sophisticated DMOs, are presenting inflated numbers to their boards provided by the data companies who want to justify their existence and also want to help and support the industry, but might be giving data that, like Zeke said at the very beginning, that they don't necessarily want to red pill everybody. They are telling everybody kind of what they want to hear. And my problem with that is that we as an industry can't move forward unless we understand or somebody's providing education about best practices related to attribution. That doesn't mean we're going to solve the attribution problem. It doesn't mean that everyone's going to use the same thing. But I still don't see how, if everybody's developing their own attribution model, how boards are ever going to believe anything a DMO
Yeah,
says.
so let me restate it, because I think you misinterpreted what I said. I don't think it's a unique attribution model for each DMO. I think it's each DMO has multiple attribution models that is the standard that the industry accepts, because there's a lot of power, to your point, in standing behind this being an industry accepted standard, like whether that's like a Longwood's ROI or Halo Effect, whether that's a tourism economic event calculator, for us to stand up in front of our stakeholders and say this event netted this community X dollars, and how we came to that number wasn't just pulled out of thin air by us. We used a model that the whole industry uses, that tourism economics developed, right? So I think you have to have that external validity to the data. But my point was not that we each go up and do this on our own, because I think that's chaos, and I think it's hard to maintain and really hard to trust. What I'm saying is, look at the situation that you're trying to make a decision in. Like there might be a decision: do I need more budget, right? Or do we have too much budget, right? That's one decision tree that a certain attribution model can help you answer, or give you insight to perhaps inform you. But if I'm saying, should I shift money from Facebook to TikTok, that would be a completely different attribution model for me to look at, right? So that's my, or should I shift it from CTV to linear TV, or vice versa, right? Those are different attribution models that I would need to answer the question. And so I think it's, to me, a model is just that. It's a simplification of the real world, right? Any model is just that. We're trying to use heuristics in a way to understand something in a more by using a more simple methodology than
Got
the
it.
reality is, right? So we're never, ever going to be 100% precise on any kind of measurement. It's impossible, right? Heisenberg's and certainly Pritzker, if you want to get into physics, will tell you that you can never measure anything to 100% precision. So what we're trying to do is do the best job we can to make an informed decision. And so we trade precision for accuracy. And there's a subtle difference between accuracy and precision that maybe one day I'll spend an hour sort of explaining that. But what we're trying to do is every decision we make, it leads us to a more accurate decision. Right now we're on the extreme where we really have thrown accuracy out the window in favor of positive results. And what we need to do is start making iterative decisions that say, let's add a new constraint to the model or new factor to the model that moves us a little bit closer to accuracy, probabilistically to accuracy. That's how we need to get there. It's not like we throw it all out and start from scratch. I think we got to move iteratively, because otherwise the risk is everything we've been saying to all our stakeholders for the last 30 years is now not trustworthy, and therefore they were not going to trust us for the next 30 years, right? So we have to be intellectually honest in that regard.
Then Zeke, let me ask you a question. I think this is where we might be able to get to a real tangible takeaway for our audience who's listening here. You've been on the vendor side, you've been on the DMO side. I actually, based on what Stuart said, I don't think an industry accepted attribution model makes as much sense now as I thought it did a couple minutes ago when I was talking. But I do feel like the board and stakeholders and DMO all have to be in alignment on how we're measuring success and what are the KPIs, not that make us all look good, but that actually indicate the job that we're doing as a DMO. And so I'm curious to you, what's the process, Zeke, of going to your stakeholders, going to your board, and even deciding on what those KPIs should be and getting everyone on the same page so that I'm not up as a DMO professional presenting the success or failure of my efforts, and the person on the other side doesn't even believe that those are the right KPIs with which to decide.
Yep. I mean, I think the easy button is you bring in experts like you guys or us or whoever. You bring in someone else to say the same thing that you've probably been saying anyway. That's kind of the formula that people find, is you bring in someone, they explain it to them, and then they believe it. I'll go back to what you guys were just kind of talking about for a second. I think you have a standard approach where if you don't change anything, this is the accepted basis for how we are going to do this. So there's a, you know, how do we determine a visitor? Who do we remove from that group? You know, whatever all those parameters are, we have that. And then each destination, based on geography, based on makeup, based on visitation, you know, if you're a city within a city, you know, in the Dallas Metroplex, DFW Metroplex, there's Frisco and Plano and Denton and Dallas and Fort Worth. And if you're one of those that's really close to all the others, you have to measure that way different than, say, a mountain town. And that's different than a beach town. And so for that reason, you know, your radius, exclusion radius may be different, or dwell time, how long someone stays before they're a visitor may be different. You know, how far are they traveling? All those things. I think what you do is you have someone come in and explain the nuance of all that to your board and educate them. And that's a great defense against disinformation, against skepticism, against, you know, bad presuppositions about how this all works, because now the board can defend itself against those bad ideas, and you guys can move together, you know, in tandem, in a more informed way. I think that's really how you do it. That's the best way. That's how we do it. We come in, we educate, here's how this works, here's what you can do with it, and here's how we handle it without, apart from you. And then based on what we've heard from the destination, here's what we think, based on what we've heard of it from them, we would recommend for you, you know, and together as a partnership, less of a light side and dark side, but more like, hey, we got to work on this together. We can actually do some really cool work and have some that we all feel good about. And that when another economist or another person tries to poke holes through it, they see this checks out. The R squared is great. Everything looks good. We don't have any problems with this analysis.
So what I heard there was this is like the rise of Skywalker when Rey and Kylo Ren joined forces at the end to destroy the reincarnation of the Emperor. So that's a
I
great
was going to say the
takeaway.
same thing. I was going to say the same thing.
Yeah, I thought so. I think it's great. And to Adam, to your point, I think knowing the KPIs that matter to your community, that's going to be different for every community, right? I mean, obviously this sort of standards like ATAX collections, but what else matters, right? If you're having a conversation around budget, in justifying your budget, then showing your performance may not be the right KPIs. Maybe showing, to Zeke's earlier point, if we don't market as well as someone else or as much as someone else, we know that they're going to steal market share from us, right? We saw that during the pandemic when destinations like Myrtle Beach and Virginia Beach continued to market and others didn't. We stole a ton of market share, right? And we had the best year we'd ever had in 2021. It sort of settled down. But when I'm looking at justifying my budget, and Myrtle Beach has a sizable budget, right? Relative to a lot of destinations, we're in a very good position. But if I start to look at that in a different perspective and start to look at that from, say, okay, how big is our economy? Well, if I've got a $16 billion tourism economy, then is my budget appropriate? If I have 20 million visitors a year, what does that work out to that I'm spending per visitor? And how does that compare to other folks? So I'll give you an insight. Like Myrtle Beach spends about $2.38 per visitor on advertising, right? The vast majority of destinations are spending $4 or $5 plus per visitor on their marketing, right? So does that mean we have too much money, or does that mean we don't have enough money, right? So I think, it's the attribution of results are important, but also looking at other KPIs that can justify the position and steel man our position in a way that we don't have to worry about inflating our numbers anymore, because the conversation about are we appropriately budgeted is off the table. We've answered that in a different way. Now let's focus on how did marketing dollars are performing relative year over year or channel to channel or things like that. So I think Zeke's 100% right, starting with the
I think that's
education.
really exciting. The possibilities, it's kind of like ESPN. The other day I saw them say Tyrese Maxey has the highest, he's among the highest scorers in NBA history across the first three games. And it's like, what kind of stat is that? Who did you guys just have that sitting on a shelf somewhere? He's up there with, I think it was like Wilt Chamberlain, and it's a really powerful point. But it's
Yeah.
like they did that because they have all the data in one place and they ran the analysis. I think for
Yeah.
tourism, what can happen when we sort of settle the advocacy question is like what you just said, Stuart. You can then say, oh wow, that $2.38 is fantastic. What about for those visitors that we that drive regional dispersion? How much does it cost to get them to do that go outside of
Yep.
the
Yep.
great parts? And maybe it's a more nuanced, maybe it's a dollar for the top spots and it's $5 for the to get them out of the normal places. Some of our mountain towns, they're like, we don't want more visitors, we want
Right.
less. And so how are
Right.
you going to prove to us that we are keeping them within our optimal range of visitation into the community? I think that's where this will get really fun, actually.
Yeah, I agree. And if we start simple, then we can obviously add complexity to the models. But I think having the courage to stand up and say there's a better way is the starting point. Bringing in expertise, whether that be a Longwoods or tourism economic or some other folks from even outside of the industry to have those conversations and start to think different. I think that's the next step. And I hope we're on the cusp of something a little different in this industry, because I do believe that what we're doing right now is not sustainable for the long term. But
I do
Zeke, this
want
has been
to,
amazing, man. We're running out of time, so I'll give you one more thought, Adam,
yeah,
and then we'll give
last thing,
Zeke the
and then
final
I'll
word.
shut up. I'll be quiet after that. But basically, I just want this to be a word of caution to all of the people in the industry that are currently reporting on performance using just the numbers that look the very best for them, because you are building a house of cards, and sooner or later, that pendulum's going to have to swing. To be more realistic. And if you don't make that change on your own, it's likely going to result in the next person that gets your job having to go through that. And so I would just say make sure you are accurately reporting and not conflating correlation and causation.
Yeah, it's definitely better to raise your hand and say, hey, we're beginning to think about this a little differently than we did in the past. And you don't have to, show that everything you're thinking about, but just say, hey, we're beginning to change the way we're thinking about this, and here's maybe why, and here's where we're going. And if you start that conversation proactively, it's a lot easier than if you get that one difficult board member that comes in and starts poking holes and you can't justify it. It doesn't hold up to scrutiny. Once the veil is lifted and there's just a man there, not a magician, it's hard to defend that position. So Zeke, I'm going to give you the final word. If you had any advice to give to the industry, what would it be related to this specifically? But I guess you could go completely in a different direction if you wanted to.
No, I would say ask interesting and difficult questions. I think that's the thing that I always did is I listened to every single pitch all the way through, and then I asked lots of questions so I could learn about what each partner is doing. And you can pretty much come up with a list of the same questions for every partner generally, and you're going to get, I mean, you're going to get great answers. Simple questions like, who is your biggest competitor? Why do you lose to them? Why do people choose them? Why do they choose you? Those sort of questions are fantastic to ask people. And then the other thing, to Adam's point, his warning and sort of Stewart's way of going about that, I would say we have access to new data now. It's not necessarily that we were wrong. We just have more visibility into how things can be better. And similar to we weren't wrong for spending, an hour to write that LinkedIn post from the show notes. We weren't wrong. We just didn't have ChatGPT to help us write it. Same thing with measurement. We didn't have certain measures. There was no phone 20 years ago to use that data. So we're evolving, and I invite you in the process of evolution and improving our metrics and our data and our story. I think that's a good way to do that.
Awesome. What a great final thought. And that is a fair comment. We do think of this as a love letter to the industry, and we do tend to be critical at times. But I think you're right, right? We're in a position for a bunch of reasons that sort of predate all of us in this industry. And so hopefully people take this the way it's meant, right? We're not being critical for the sake of being critical. We're trying to encourage folks to be better tomorrow than they were today. So I think it is that's a very fair point that things are different today. We do have the access to data and technology that we didn't have even 12 months ago. So thank you for listening, everyone, or watching, whether you're on YouTube or whether you're on listening on a podcast now. Please be sure to subscribe, leave a review. That would be great. Adam, if they want to find you, connect with you, what's the best way to do that?
Adam at relicagency.com or Adam Stoker on LinkedIn.
Great. And Zeke, where can they find you?
Zeke Coleman on LinkedIn and zcoleman@oxfordeconomics.com if you want to email me.
Great. Thank you all. Thank you for being with us, Zeke, today. You can find me at Stuart Butler on LinkedIn. And until next time, this has been Destination Discourse.
Yeah, definitely. Let's hang out. I owe you a beer.
I will not turn that down. That's for sure.